Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and you are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this magical network known as Blog Talk Radio. As we celebrate fall, has already moved into the Midwest. It's gotten a little bit cooler, and I guess we're ready. I have to tell everyone, too, we've just started our school assembly schedule with our wild animals, so we're very excited, my wife and I, that we have an opportunity to share our wild animal ambassadors with thousands of school children this coming year, and it's going to be a great year, and look forward to their smiling, their little smiling faces. That's right. Handling the technical responsibilities tonight, studio producer Melissa Hovey, as well as co-hosting duties tonight, and Wayne Larson is our technical engineer. Music provided by Jim Johnson and technical expertise by Scott Carney. And from his massive Wild World News studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, the honorable, distinguished, and regular Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Oh, why, thank you. And good evening to you, Mr. Batson. Well, it looks like my hummingbirds have moved out of the city here. Do you have any hummingbirds left?
Well, we've got a couple stragglers that have hung around. They just won't leave. The bees haven't driven them away yet. I tried to take down the hummingbird feeder, and they peek in the windows and look at me, and I felt guilty, so I put it back out.
Yeah. Okay, well, then I'll leave mine out for a few more days. And the locusts are done, too, I guess. I haven't heard of locusts in a few days.
You know, now that you mention it, I haven't either. I didn't even think about it.
And I think summer's over.
Yeah. I did see a walking stick today, though. That's always exciting.
Yeah.
You know, we forgot to mention who's the guest tonight.
Oh, we did. I've forgotten.
Handling the interview tonight will be Melissa Hovey, and she will be interviewing yours truly. And as she said, it's going to be like it's going to be an interrogation, she tells me. So we'll see what happens tonight.
Well, good. I'm looking forward to it because I know Melissa's going to do a good job with you tonight.
Oh, well, she I'm certain she will after the wonderful interview she did with the Monterey Bay Aquarium and Great White Sharks.
That was a great show.
Was a great show. The following portion of Larry Batson's Wild World is brought to you by Alphabet Swamp, the new children's book by Cheryl and Larry Batson. Order your autographed copy today at www.LarryTheAnimalGuy.com or send check or money order for $10 per copy. And those are autographed, by the way. Christmas is coming not too far away. Send that money to WES 4140 North 600 West Greencastle, Indiana 46135. Shipping and handling included.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good evening. This is Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News for September 15. Now, even though it's ancient history, it's still animal news. Let's head off to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Research scientists at the Academy of Natural Sciences have discovered a new species of ancient fish they named Lecognathus embryi. Now, it's a large predatory fish with a powerful bite that prowled the ancient North American waterways around 3.5 million years ago. And they estimate that it probably grew up to about 6 foot long.
Oh, my. That's a good-sized fish.
They're still discovering things out there. And it's, you know, what do? You split a rock and there you go.
Yeah, pretty much.
3.375 million years ago. That's quite a while.
Yeah, just
all right. Now we're going to head off to Marathon Key, one of my favorite places in Florida. Used to spend a lot of time there. The Sea Hospital has saved another one. Sea Hospital Director Richie Moretti released a loggerhead turtle yesterday into the sea off of Marathon, Florida. Now, here's what happened to the poor little guy. It suffered a spear gun shot to its head.
Oh!
Now, you have to be, I won't use any foul language, but you have to be pretty stupid.
Yeah.
Shoot a turtle in the head with a spear gun.
Yes,
now,
or
the
jerk.
Locals are pretty upset about it, and they've already amassed a $16,000 reward for any information in this case.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know how things are. We're going to take care of this. We'll find out who did this.
Yeah, we'll put our investigative team on this.
That's right. That's just stupid.
They're on it now.
All right. Now, this was a learning lesson for our national emblem, Williamsburg, Virginia. Well, when Hurricane Irene came through, it destroyed and damaged many of the bald eagle nests along the James River.
Mm.
Now, the Center for Conservation Biology of Virginia Commonwealth University and the College of William and Mary said that nearly 21% of the 154 nests that they logged in were lost, and another 23% were damaged.
Oh, man.
So, and you know what, you know, that's just going to help the birds make a better nest next year.
Too bad.
It's too bad, but, it, you know, like I said, it was a learning thing.
Yep.
All right, if you're heading off to Hawaii anytime here in the near future.
I'm leaving tomorrow. Strong,
are you?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'll stow away in your luggage then, because I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
All right, Honolulu, Hawaii. Strong trade winds are bringing sea slugs and a seaweed into the beaches there that cause skin irritations.
I'm not going now.
The blue sea slugs, also known as sea swallows, are being reported on the windward beaches. Now, the trade winds are also bringing ashore a seagrass known as the stinging lemu or the fireweed.
Mm.
And I've dealt with both of them, and I kind of like it.
You're a sick puppy.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. I guess I am.
Yeah.
Well, this next story, it wouldn't make a lot of people happy, but I think you and I would appreciate it.
Yeah.
Tucson, Arizona. Now, summer storms bring out all kinds of desert critters.
Mm.
But this one could be lurking in your garage or backyard. Now, the Gila monsters, or, you know, Gila monster lizards, for people who don't know what a Gila monster is, their venom is as strong as a diamondback rattlesnake.
Yes.
They can deliver venom by biting down. And, you know, they have to chew for a while to get that venom out.
Yeah.
Which could be a painful thing. But you've had a couple of Gila monsters over the years, haven't you?
I have one now that I've had for, let me think, 33 years.
Now, that's unbelievable.
Yeah. 33 years. Yep.
That's a good life for a lizard.
Well, I was told they live 50, so. But yeah, long time.
It's going to outlive us, probably.
More than likely.
All right, well, let's do the local news. Linton, Indiana. Bird watchers at the Goose Pond Fish and Wildlife Area spotted 5 Hudsonian godwits this month.
Oh.
Now, the godwit is a rare shorebird. And it is even rarer visitor to the inland areas. The birds spend a few days at the wetland-filled site before resuming their fall migration. Now, the Hudsonian godwits breed in the Arctic and winter in remote areas of southern South America.
Well, that's fantastic. That's not too far from the animal compound.
That's right.
Well, an hour and a half, you know. Which isn't very far.
But that's pretty interesting that they just want to stop by. Listen.
Say hi. Yeah.
And say hi, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, how you doing here, Hoosiers?
All right. Well, we've got some more reptile news.
Oh.
Veterinarians are reporting a rise in the number of dogs being treated for rattlesnake bites in North Platte, Nebraska. This is going on all across the United States. The weather, some places you have the drought, so it brings them in, and sometimes, and then you have the states that get all the rain, and of course that flushes them out. But they're finding that a lot of the hunters, while they're out in the hunting season, the dogs are getting bitten by rattlesnakes.
Yeah, that happens.
Happens a lot.
Yeah.
Now, here's an interesting story. Who would have ever thunk it? Burbank, California. A businessman involved in months of illegal wrangling for allegedly feeding pigeons near Bob Hope Airport has pleaded guilty to nuisance charges involving air safety. Now, Charles Douglas entered the plea to the misdemeanor charges of disobeying a court order and creating a public nuisance. Now, he's accused of feeding pigeons at his Precise Roofing Company.
He should be jailed.
Yes, he should be. Feeding pigeons.
That's
a problem at the airport.
That's almost terrorism.
Yeah. I'll have to agree with you.
Yeah.
All right. Kodiak, Alaska, the survey of rockfish on the Alaskan Peninsula has found a greater number than expected. And so they're saying if you want to get out there and fish, now's the time to do it. Also, Plantersville, Texas, the pet monkeys on the loose and biting people. So
good. Outstanding.
Now, you've been bit by a monkey?
Oh, many.
many times. That's right.
What kind of monkey is it, Dr. Day?
It was a rhesus monkey. So.
Oh, the research monkey. Oh, my. Those are fairly... That's the monkey that's on the program on Animal Planet. I think it's called Rebel Monkeys. Have you ever watched that?
I don't believe I've seen that.
Well, it's something else, but good luck with catching that. That's going to take
exactly. That was my first thought. Well, he's going to have a great time.
Oh, and they can live in cold weather, too, so.
Yep. All right, well, let's end up the Wild World News for September 15th with the fact of the day. Now, the saguaro cactus found in the southwestern United States, Arizona, basically,
yep.
The only place it grows. And they're always, they're familiar in the old westerns. They're the big, it's like a giant barrel cactus with a couple of arms sticking out. The natives used to call it the man of the desert.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the saguaro does not grow branches or arms until it's 75 years old.
Oh, really?
Yes. So most of the saguaros that you see out there are quite old.
I did not know that.
Nor I, but well, I wanted to share it with everybody. Well, that's the Wild World News.
Well, once again, an outstanding job by Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News. We greatly appreciate Dr. Day and the efforts of his staff that put this together for us each week. We want to tell everyone to check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and our brand new Facebook page, Larry the Animal Guy and Friends, filled with photos and information about our animal family. Also, RadioMom.fm and the home of the Radio Mom Shop, where you can save 50, 60, 70% on vacations, restaurants, and a variety of other goods and services. And why not listen to my show, The 70s on Sunday, 12 to 7, each Sunday, at RadioMom.fm. And also the exciting new iKids Fishing Show. The iKidsFishing.com is the first fishing show in the USA starring kids teaching kids how to fish. 40 million fishermen spending $45 billion a year. The iKids Fishing Show is a keeper. More info at We Want You Cottages in beautiful Chautauqua Lake in western New York. Here's their website, www.weewanchu.com. And folks, it's one of America's finest fishing resorts. Also, McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. We call it God's Country. Go to their website, info@mcgregormountainlodge.com, and also Michael Hodges is going to be with us in a few weeks. We're going to talk about the Rocky Mountains, Rocky Mountain National Park, and his fine facility that he has there. So we recommend everyone to listen that week, but also check out McGregor Mountain Lodge. Those are our underwriters that make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is
Larry Batson,
and I am a wilderness explorer in Tribe 54. Are you in need of any assistance today, sir?
It's the 70s on Sunday.
American woman, stay away from me. Welcome to the Hotel California.
It's the 70s on Sunday, 12 to 7, with the animal guy, Larry Batson.
We sent him to school this morning, a fine, strapping boy. And tonight he came home looking like a rather ugly girl.
You're listening to the animal guy, Larry Batson.
Mental note, rethink career in broadcasting.
Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Melissa Hovey, and tonight I'm the special guest for Larry Batson's Wild World as the host. And I'm going to quickly introduce our guest for tonight, which you all know and I'm sure love, Mr. Larry Batson. Good evening, Mr. Batson.
Good evening.
Are you ready for this?
Well, I certainly hope so. I've studied all week for this, so.
Well, that's good. That's good. I'm glad to hear that you took my warning seriously.
Well, I did, and I'll tell you what, after the wonderful job you did with the gentleman from the Monterey Bay Aquarium, darn it, I'm having a brain fade. What is his name?
Mr. Jim Covell.
That's right. That's exactly, took the words right. I thought, what an outstanding job and how well you questioned him, so I'm worried.
Well, you know, just to add in a little information for the listeners out there, this isn't our first go-round, Mr. Batson.
Oh, it's not.
We've been interviewer and interviewee a couple of different times for a different program, but I'm gonna put you through it for your own show this time.
Oh well, thank you. I think.
Okay, well, why don't we start it out with this? Why don't you tell your listeners a little bit, because, you know, this, I think, is a really important question as to why you do what you do, which we all know is educating the public about animals, because I think that's probably more important, and I don't think you're going to educate animals about us.
Right.
So tell the listeners why it is so important for people to learn about the animals that you love so much.
Well, I think one of the most important things, kids right now are so attuned to either television or their computer screens or their games they play, and they really never get in touch with the outdoors. And for, well, this will be 33 years we've been visiting schools with our wild animals, and to have a chance to see an animal in person, live, 3D, being themselves, because we never worked with or have had what we call performing or trained animals, that we realize that when we're speaking to a group of children, and each year we reach about, I think I counted about 90,000 last year, we're not speaking to a group of future zoologists or scientists or anything like that necessarily, though they've written me over the years and they've gone on to do jobs like that. But they're a group of people that are going to grow up and be voters, and they're going to understand hopefully why we need to save places like Yellowstone National Park and various wild areas around the world, why animals like tigers need a home to live in the wild. And every time we lose a species on this planet, we're basically losing a part of our life as well. And if our planet cannot support our wildlife, there's no way that it can support us. So I've always, and to tell you what, when you see the young people's response to the animals, it's just a feeling I just can't. When we go back to work every fall and start visiting schools once again, we realize why we do it. Sometimes in the summer when things are kind of slow and we've kind of forgotten what we do, we wonder why we've ever gotten into this crazy job where you work 14, 15 hours a day taking care of animals and whatnot. But once we go walk into that school building, those school children see them and they respond to them, then we realize how important it really is.
Well, I know, you know, you have animals at your compound. I call it a compound because I can't think of too many people that are crazy enough to spend time there without you right next to them. But you have an olive baboon.
Mm-hmm.
You have wolf.
You have tigers.
You have bears.
Mm-hmm.
You have alligators. And when I say alligators, you have a ton of alligators.
Yeah.
But what really interests me about the animals that you have is the tigers, because that's not your typical type of that's a pet that requires quite a bit of care and concern. What is it about the tiger that made you decide to get your first tiger? I mean, what was it about that animal?
Well, we realized how important it was for children to see animals like tigers, so we get them as cubs. We usually start when they're 3 or 4 weeks old, still in the bottle, and still dependent on constant care. Then we start doing the school season, and by the time May has rolled around, the school year is about over, the tiger, which we start with in the spring, which may weigh anywhere from 5 to 10 pounds, by that time is going 150 pounds or so. So it's chances or it's opportunities to go to school are over. It's just outgrowing the job. So we keep them. We put up an enclosure, and right now we have 6 tigers that have done that with us, have gone to schools with us, and basically we feel the responsibility of having these animals because they've helped us out by doing the school programs, and they do such a great job. And like I tell these children, I said, you know, when I was your age, which is a long time ago, the jungles and forests of India had they're estimating, you know, at least 60 to 80,000 tigers. Now the number is less than 2,000. So we can see how quickly they're disappearing. And as I said before, they really need a chance to see these things in person to really appreciate them. And gosh, how cool can it be to see a young tiger? I mean, to go to school and sit in your gymnasium and learn about that animal and see it and watch it be itself. We call it the amazing world of animals because animals are just that. They're amazing. They're incredible.
And exactly what type of tigers do you have?
Well, we have 6 Bengal tigers, and those are the
wow.
ones from India. Yeah, we had a Siberian years ago. His name was Louis. He was quite a giant. He was almost 700 pounds, and he passed away. But now we have the 6. We have Luke. We have Lily. We have Molly, Rita, Trace, and Hank.
Wow.
Yeah, and Trace is the biggest. He's probably 550.
You and I have talked a little bit before about the captive breeding programs for tigers because their numbers are dwindling in the wild. Can you talk a little bit about that and whether or not you and your wife have ever considered being a part of that program and why you haven't, or are you considering it?
Well, here's the problem. Their natural habitat is disappearing. I mean, if there was enough forest for the tigers to live in, the numbers would be back up again. Because you put a tiger in its own domain and you protect it somewhat from poachers and hunting, that they'll survive, they'll thrive, and they'll populate. But the forest of India is disappearing just like the rainforest of the Amazon. And there's essentially no place for them to go in the wild. What's really most people don't realize is there's more tigers in captivity in the USA than that are left in the wilds of India.
Well, then, I mean, how do you feel about the programs out there for other animals where they're doing the captive breeding programs and then releasing them? I mean, do you think that's a good idea, or do you think that it's not? I mean, what's your opinion?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea if they have the habitat to support them. Absolutely, between the baby turtles, the sea turtles or whatever. I know the orangutans, they've got couple reserves in Borneo and Sumatra where the orphan orangutans are raised to be re-released in the wild. I think all those programs are great. But to raise tigers, and it's too complicated. I mean, tigers set up territories. Male tigers have areas that they manage. And you can't just pluck tigers drop tigers into the wild and hope that they'll survive, because it just doesn't work that way. It has to be a natural evolution, and basically we have to have enough forest to support more tigers, which we don't have now, and that's the whole problem.
So how long do you think it'll be before tigers are no longer in the wild and only in captivity?
I think a lot of times scientists guesstimate within the next 20 to 30 years.
Seriously?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's actually pretty shocking.
Well, you consider worldwide, well, in India there was, 50 years ago there was 40, 50,000 tigers, and now there's less than 2,000. So, you know, do the math on that one, because within 40, 50 years, they'll probably be gone. Also, there's drastic changes made. And I can't see that because of the economics of these countries. You know, when you get somebody in there willing to pay these people lots of money for their trees, and they have no money, you know, they don't care about striped kitty cat that lives in the forest. All they care about is trying to feed and support their family. So that's, and it's the same situation for the Amazon and Borneo and Sumatra, all of our wild forests in the world.
Well, let me see if I've got a handle on this. See, I know that the captive breeding program, they're using, let's call it donations. We have children listening.
Mm-hmm.
Tigers that are already in captivity. But now I know that there's a problem because of inbreeding.
Right.
With captivity.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens with the tigers that are in captivity with the whole inbreeding problem when there's no tigers in the wild? What's going to happen to the tigers in captivity?
They're going to grow old and just die in captivity. You know, that's just the facts of it, you know.
Well, eventually, regardless.
Oh, I'm sorry?
I mean, is it your opinion that eventually they're just going to, I mean, even if they're still in captivity, we're going to end up losing the tiger because of the problem of inbreeding and the numbers that we have in files, you know, as far as donations?
Well, they'll always, you know, I think for a long time they'll be in captivity. You know, the zoos have a definite program put together. Most of your captive tigers that are owned and raised by individuals, a lot of them are inbred, especially with the popularity recently of the white tiger, which is nothing but an inbred animal. And, you know, I've been offered in the past to lecture with white tigers, and I have absolutely no interest because, you know, I'm more interested in lecturing with wild animals and not man-made inbred captive animals.
Okay. All right, well, we're just about at the half-hour point, so we're going to go ahead and take a break and do some PSAs for the program, and stay tuned, folks, and we'll be back with more Larry Batson and Larry Batson's Wild World. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Here's a hot topic about our wildlands and living with the natural role of fire.
Yard work is not just a matter of pride when you live in the wildland urban interface. It's also about survival. Here are some FireWise tips that can help protect your home from wildland fire. Prune your trees 6 to 10 feet above the ground. Remove dead leaves and branches and dispose of them before fire season. Water your lawn regularly and store firewood away from the house. Be prepared for a fire emergency by having a plan for your family and pets. Learn more at our website, and then sit back and enjoy. You worked for it.
This hot topic was made possible by the Teresa and H. John Hines III Foundation. Learn more about the natural role of fire, how to protect your community, and get the latest fire information. Visit the National Interagency Fire Center website at NIFC.gov. That's NIFC.gov.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everyone. This is Larry Batson. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. We want to tell everyone that next week on the program, Shelley Leibowitz from Los Angeles, California, record producer, film producer, and we've got some exciting news. In fact, this is kind of a big deal for us. It's just been announced that he's going to do a major motion picture with Snoop Dogg and the life of famed legendary bluesman Fillmore Slim. So we're going to be talking about that next week. We feel we've got a major coup here, so we're very excited. We also remind everyone that you can go to the archives and listen to all the shows from the past and download them, including tonight's, if you wish, at www.blogtalkradio.com/Larry-Batson. Also, a big thank you to Tire Service Plus and owner Jerry Jones, taking care of America's auto maintenance needs. They keep our animal truck on the road, traveling thousands of miles with our wild animal ambassadors. Give them a call at 317-243-0700. And a big thank you to all of our individual underwriters who help support our program. We appreciate their donations. Go to the website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and you'll see the contact. And you can become an individual underwriter, make it possible for this broadcast to be on each Thursday night at 10 o'clock, and also available free downloads after the live broadcast. And I will turn it back over to our guest host tonight, the lovely, distinguished Melissa Hovey.
Yeah, flattery will get you everywhere, Mr. Batson.
I know.
Okay, we were, you know, just talking about your tigers, and I love your tigers. I think that's just awesome. But, you know, I mean, I think that it's important for people to consider the fact that predator animals are very important to the ecology, you know, regardless of where in the country they are, whether they be land-based or ocean animals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. Well, every animal is important. Every animal is a part of this machine called the our ecosystem. And when one animal leaves, you know, our ecosystem is affected. You know, they're discovering new species all the time, but they're also losing new species all the time. And of course, the greatest barometer of our environment is the amphibians and frogs. And they say that, you know, the decline of those tells us that, hey, we're not doing well. So, but there's the old saying too, that here in the USA, that there are more animals that live here now than there did 200 years ago. So, you know, what do you do? But it's true. We need our predators, and our predators have disappeared all across North America just because of people's ignorance and people's lack of knowledge about them.
Right.
I think that the biggest thing was we had a mountain lion escape from a feline rescue center not too far from here. It was a wild mountain lion, never been accustomed to humans at all. So when it escaped, I really didn't think anything about it because we have such a healthy deer population. There's plenty for it to eat. But I had the local school superintendent call me. He said, boy, he says, I've had parents call because here's this mountain lion on the loose, and we've got kids on bus stops every morning. Well, I explained to him that it was a wild cat, and it had never been imprinted by humans. And think about this, there are kids on bus stops in Utah, Wyoming, Montana, and Colorado every morning. So he said, thank you, I've got something to tell my parents now. So, but we're afraid of things we don't understand or don't know anything about.
That's very true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that observation has led to, you know, the slaughter of animals all over the world. You know,
oh, it has?
Yeah.
Look at the wolf.
Yeah, I mean, pardon?
Look at the wolf.
Yeah, and that's just now starting to come back.
And starting to come back, then you have people, politicians that want to pass laws or have passed laws to be able to kill them out of helicopters. I mean, it's complete ignorance of our ecosystem on how everything works. They just don't get it.
you know, it's that age-old problem of how do you balance man and nature? You know, it's you know, that's personally the way I take it. But, you know, here recently, and this kind of goes into the whole government question, you know, the government eased the restrictions on industry. You know, they relaxed the EPA regulations.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that's going to have an effect? I mean, do you think it's going to have an effect on the wildlife in this country or no?
Well, it just depends. You know, it depends on what industry you're talking about. If you're talking about the timber industry, of course that will. If you're talking about operations of oil drilling in our oceans, of course that will. I mean, whatever affects, you know, our wild places, that's the key. And it just depends on the particular industry. You know, the timber industry, you know, they got shut down in Washington because of the spotted owl. And boy, you talk about, of course, that's, you know, part of their economy. You know, the lumberjacks still have to work, and they didn't think it was that important that this little owl have a home to live in, but U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service made sure that they did understand that that little owl does need a home to live in.
Well, yeah, and the whole argument there, though, was that, you know, I'm kind of taking the devil's advocate here, but, you know, the whole argument there was, you know, that the machinery and the all this other stuff was going to affect the habitat of the animal, but then the owl ended up thriving by building nests within the equipment and stuff. So, I mean, so there again, you have that balance. I mean, how do you strike that balance? If you could send a message to the government about the environment and how to help it, what would that message be, Larry?
Well, each situation has to be studied. We have bald eagles that have nests on our right within a half mile of our home, right along the highway, where these huge gravel trucks bounce down that road every day, and it doesn't affect them at all. And if they'd have done a little study into the spotted owl, realizing that they didn't care whether, you know, the equipment was around, and they'd still continue to nest and so forth. You know, one thing about the spotted owl, which was never really brought out, as far as the bird of prey species in the world, owls aren't very smart. So for them to thrive amongst all that noise and commotion, that doesn't surprise me whatsoever. But, we just have to look at each situation and decide after careful study what actually needs to be done, you know. And for the government to do things like say it's okay. You know, basically the government put a bounty on wolves years ago and pretty much almost wiped out the population. And not realizing that when the wolf was gone, how it was going to affect other wildlife. We'd had Doug Chadwick on, and he talked how the elk now in Yellowstone, they're not consuming all the trees because the elk are kept moving by the wolves' migrations and their hunting skills and what they do. So each situation has to be looked at differently. And really by people that are knowledgeable about animals, not politicians.
Well, do you think the government's talking to the right people?
Well, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has some very skilled scientists and naturalists and zoologists and biologists that work with them. And usually the U.S. Fish and Wildlife are pretty much on the money. I mean, they've missed it a couple times, but normally they've got it pretty much under control. So I think if we hand it over to them, and, of course, there's a lot of people that are going to disagree with that. You know, people in the lumber industry will say, you know, situation with the spotted owl, or ranchers in Idaho and Wyoming, Montana will say with the wolves. And I had a friend that lives in British Columbia, and I wrote an article years ago, wouldn't it be great to introduce the wolf back into Indiana because of our overpopulation of deer? I might as well said Hitler was a good guy because I received so many negative letters and so forth, and gosh, he said, they would slaughter our livestock. So I called a friend of mine in British Columbia. I said, now, you have ranchers up there? He said, oh, yeah. I said, you have wolves? He said, oh, yeah. I said, are the ranchers concerned with the wolves? He says, well, not really. They lose more cattle to lightning. So, you know, they just need to understand the right situation, have the right people making those decisions. And many times that doesn't happen.
Right. Okay, well, I'm going to switch gears here a little bit, and I'm going to continue to play devil's advocate here.
Okay.
You've been involved for many, many, many years with wildlife conservation and education of people. You know, you've worked with people like Marlon Perkins, which I totally applaud you for, and you've worked with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is phenomenal. What would possess someone like you to get involved with the field of Bigfoot research?
Well, I'll tell you what got me. I've always had an interest in it. But years ago, I was in Callaway Gardens in Columbus, Georgia, with my good friend and co-host of Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, Jim Fowler. And over breakfast one morning, he was talking about a television program that they were shooting a pilot for in Russia called Spirit of Adventure. And they had gone over there to Russia to film about the Russian brown bear. Well, it seems that the guides, all they wanted to talk about to him was a Bigfoot, Sasquatch, because they had seen and found things that was very similar to what was being found in Washington, California, and Oregon. So over that conversation, you know, I thought, wow. So it kind of got wheels turning. And not long after that, I was contacted by a company in Ohio that produced several outdoor shows. And this was in the early 80s. And they said, hey, we're looking for new ideas for presentations and that sort of thing. I'd worked for them for a number of years doing animal programs. So I pitched them. I said, well, why don't we try and put together something on Bigfoot or Sasquatch? And they said, well, that sounds outstanding. He says, I says, cool. I says, I'll put a display together and so forth, and I'll do a little research, and we had a pretty good budget. So I decided that at first when I was going to do this, that I was going to, and I looked into it for a number of years before, but I really hadn't made a decision about the whole thing. So I started making some phone calls, and the first call I made was to a variety store in a place called Willow Creek, California. And it was called Hodgson's Variety Store, and I talked to a gentleman that owned it named Al Hodgson, and I told him what we were doing. I said, we have an outdoor show, and we want to put this exhibit together, and do you have things that we could display, like, you know, coffee mugs and souvenirs? And he said, oh, I have a lot of stuff. So he said, I'll send it to you. I said, fantastic. I said, now, so while I have you on the phone, I said, do you know of anyone that's supposedly seen one of these things that I could talk to? And he said, well, there was a couple people in here not long ago, well, a couple years earlier, I guess, that he said I could call them. And he said, hold on, let me get their numbers, because they left a number and names and so forth. And one of the guys' name was Bob Titmus, and the other fellow's name was John Green, and they both lived in Harrison Hot Springs, British Columbia. So the first call I made was to John Green, very naive, and I talked to him, and it turns out that he was quite the, I don't know if I should use the word authority, he's done a lot of research on it, written several books, and I asked him, you know, this and that, and he said I needed to call the other fellow, Bob Titmus, who lived about three blocks from him. Well, our conversation also, Mr. Green agreed to come to Cleveland, Ohio for 3 days and do a program at the sports show. And I thought that was rather remarkable, because Harrison Hot Springs is one of the most beautiful places in the world, and he was willing to fly clear across the country and come to Cleveland, Ohio for 3 days. I thought, wow. So he agreed to do that, and he said, you need to call Bob. So I called Mr. Titmus up, and at first he was pretty dry. He wasn't really wanting to talk very much, and I kind of, you know, broke the ice a little bit and told him what we were trying to do. Then I finally asked him, I said, have you ever seen one of these things? Now, before this conversation started, I was going to have fun with this exhibit, very sarcastic, you know, I wasn't going to take it too seriously. And he told me, after a few moments of silence, he says, yes, he says, I've seen them twice. And I asked him, give me some details. He said, well, in 1941, I was in the Wrangell Narrows off the coast of Alaska. I was on a ship in the Navy, and I was up on the deck just about dusk, and I looked along the shoreline, and there, walking along the shoreline, was this animal, creature, whatever you want to call it, that was walking bipedal, two-legged, with brown hair, quite large. He says, I watched it for some time, and it walked up into the bush, walked away, and he never said anything to anyone on the ship about it, but he decided that when he got back that he was going to, that was going to be his full-time occupation, is hunting this thing. Well, Bob Titmus was a taxidermist. In his own words, he had stuffed just about what he had thought every animal that lived in that part of the country, British Columbia, Alaska, throughout Canada, but he'd never stuffed one of those. So that was going to be his occupation, is to try to hunt this thing. So turns out in 1963, I believe, in a little town called Kitimat, British Columbia, he was doing research. He's back in the backcountry by himself, and he watched three of these things freestyle up a rock cliff that was basically a rock wall, I should say. And they could watch them feel with their hands and pull their body up. And he said this 1,500-foot rock cliff or wall, they climbed in about a half hour. It would have taken a man all day. And basically, Melissa, after I finished that conversation and hung up the phone, it all changed. I realized that there was definitely something to this because he was quite believable. And then when I did more research on it, they just kept going on and on and on until today, now that I have the testimony of Yellowstone Park Ranger Bob Jackson. While on patrol in Yellowstone, he claims he saw one stalk a deer that I realized that there's a living animal that's essentially probably the most fascinating animal we have on this planet. That has been seen by thousands, and still, as far as the scientific community, though that's changing very quickly, we're realizing that the existence of this animal, man-like animal, is true, real.
Through all your years of research, you know, into this animal, do you see any parallels between this animal and any other one that's on the planet that we know about?
I find a parallel to tribes that live in different parts of the world. I was watching a special about New Guinea, and they were studying this particular tribe that lived in the forest in New Guinea, and the scientist he basically said, we go into these forests, and we don't always find these people. Basically, we find them when they want us to. And I've done a lot of talking to people that have done studies. There, of course, was the film that was shot in 67, I believe, Roger Patterson. And basically the studies there, I asked one gentleman who'd studied it quite extensively, knew prehistoric man quite well. He thought it was very similar to Neanderthal, which makes all the sense in the world. So, like I've always said, it's not a big monkey, because if it was a big monkey, we'd have it already. It'd be in a zoo somewhere. It's more than that. It's a primitive man, or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I know that you do a lot of work with the National Park or the National Park Service.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
There you go.
Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, do they show any interest in trying to help protect this animal? Are they doing anything to actively document this animal? I mean, what are they doing? Are they doing anything?
Oh, yes. And I don't know everything that they do. Of course, they produced a written news release in 77, on what they would do if one was killed or found, and what action would be taken, and the procedures involved. And it was quite extensive. It was a two-page news release that they produced. In fact, when I did my program for them, and I've done two programs for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I found out a lot of information how they've been, you know, many of the park rangers and people across the country that work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Before my program, they were kind of afraid to discuss this at all, but after the fact and after it got out, in fact, we did a television interview that was broadcast at thousands of outlets all across North America to U.S. Fish and Wildlife sanctuaries, and I think they said, well, almost 2,000 outlets received this interview that I did with them. And I received so many emails and so many comments stating that, thank you, we were always afraid to discuss it in the past. It's all changed now. And I think it kind of all finalized to me is when Yellowstone Park Ranger Bob Jackson talked about not only his sighting in Yellowstone, but all the things that have occurred in Yellowstone, the trail crews, what they've ran into, the tracks they found, the evidence they found, the sounds they've heard. And then I find out it's happened to National Forest in Wyoming and Montana and Colorado and Utah. It's just remarkable. I mean, so my goal when I first started was to prove it to myself that that these things existed, and I've done that.
So, I mean, what's next for you as far as, you know, Bigfoot research is concerned? Are you still getting out there looking, or are you just convinced and that's all you need to know?
Oh, I'm totally convinced, and my old thing is if you're looking for it, you ain't going to find it. that's the key.
Yeah, there's with you on that.
Yeah, well, I've sat on the television and watched the programs like Monster Quest and, oh, there was a new one out not long ago, and I just sat back and laughed, and I thought to myself, there is no way. I mean, something that's been this elusive for as long as it has, and this rare as long as it has, a group of guys in camouflage with ATVs and walkie-talkies and cameras hanging on every tree and traipsing around in the woods at night are ever going to prove anything, because it just ain't going to happen. I mean, I've always said you could put these guys in the forest looking for a mountain lion, and we know those exist in parts of the country, and they couldn't find that, let alone something 10 times as intelligent and elusive as one of these. I mean, gosh almighty. But it makes okay TV, I guess.
Well, you know, I mean, there's, you know, going back to devil's advocate here, you know, there's the constant comparison to the time and difficulty that it took to prove that the mountain gorilla existed.
Oh, yeah.
In Africa. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that if, even though we're out there looking for this animal, do you think that it's still going to be as long of a time, is it going to take as long, or it's just not going to happen, even though we're out there actively looking? I mean, there's hundreds of researchers across the country. I mean, do you think it's going to take as long to discover this animal, or maybe even longer than the mountain gorilla?
Well, it's hard to say. There may be one day that somebody gets lucky and brings one or part of one back and can prove its existence. I mean, you know, we have all these films and photographs that turn up every once in a while, blurry black images in the forest, and still the best evidence was shot by Patterson and Gimlin. There's been nothing better than that since then. So, you know, it makes one wonder. I think what has to happen, though, is we need better people behind it. Let's say scientists, per se. Now, there are some scientists that are pursuing it, but with not, you know, any more results than the amateurs walking around in the woods trying to prove its existence. So it's just hard to say. It's, you know, the mountain gorilla is a ape, and we knew for sure where they were. And so they find them now on tourist trips up in the mountains. I mean, you can take tourists up there and you'll see gorillas. I don't ever foresee that day where you can take a group of tourists into the Cascade Mountains of Washington and go look at these things. I don't think that's ever going to happen. So, you know, it's just John Green, he pretty much said it all. The longer you look into it, the more questions you have. You know, it's just, I can't physically see anyone ever trying to capture one. I can't physically see anybody ever being able to bring one down with a tranquilizer dart. Because that's...
Watch them try.
Well, you can try, but, I mean, even wild animals that we're familiar with and know their weights and what they're made up of, it's still a tricky proposition.
Well, yeah, let me just change that a little bit. I'd like to watch from a distance, because I think that would probably be very comical.
Well, I tell the old story. Well, there's an old story in Washington. I have a good friend who's, as he puts it, lives amongst them. And there was a tribe of Indians up there in Washington that two or three of the young men had gone back to this area to go salmon fishing, and they didn't come back. And they sent the tribal elders into that area looking for them. And the first one they found underneath a pile of rocks, dead. The third one, or the second one, I believe, he was found in similar condition. And the third one was basically found in a crumpled mess with his brain tissue on every tree in a perfect circle about around where his body laid. And I always think about the Native American that told me once that she could take me where they are, but you'll be risking your life. And I said, why is that? He said, because if you get between a male and a female, or a male and a baby, he'll grab you by the ankles and beat you up against a tree. Well, I laughed about that at that moment, but after I heard the story from Washington about the what it looked like, someone had grabbed that young Indian by his ankles and beat his head up against a tree in a perfect circle, it was, So I don't know.
Okay, well, we're going to kind of change gears here a little bit. So I'm gonna bring, you know, yeah, I have to be able to sleep tonight, Larry. We're going to bring back in your old friend, Dr. Henry Day. Dr. Day, you still with us?
Yes, I am, Melissa.
I got a specific question for you. Seems how you know Henry, or seems how you know Dr. or Larry Batson so darn well. Do you have any idea where his favorite place on Earth is?
Well, let me think about that. I'm going to have to guess and say Estes Park, Colorado.
Mr. Batson?
That's pretty much true. I think our regular listeners will agree with that, yeah.
Yeah, we give you a lot of grief about that, Larry, but why don't you tell people why you like that place so much?
Well, I'll tell you, I was taken there by my parents since as a young child. We'd go every year for 2 weeks in August, and it's just like a very special place to me, and I know it so well now. And basically, when you go there, and it's hard to explain, and someone that's never been to the mountains before, it's like a religious experience, and it's just a special place, and I just love it, and I miss it very much. I haven't had a chance to go for some time, and well, we're raising a baby baboon, so I doubt we'll be going anytime soon.
Well, since we have this golden opportunity to have somebody on the program who actually, you know, has known you for quite some time. Dr. Day, is there anything that you think the listeners should know about Mr. Batson?
Oh, my God. a lot of people don't know that he's a musician, plays piano, violin. He can pretty much pick up about any instrument and make music with it.
Noise.
That's pretty darn cool.
Yeah.
All right. We're almost at the end of the program, and I think I'm done embarrassing you for now.
Well, you didn't embarrass me at all. You did a masterful job, as always, and I felt quite at ease, and really no question. I thought you did a fantastic job of research. Good show, Dr. Day. What do you think?
No kidding. And she touched on some very important points tonight.
Yeah, if you could edit me out most, it would be a heck of a good program.
It'd be a perfect show.
It would be absolutely perfect. We'd like to thank Melissa Hovey for guest hosting tonight. Great job, Melissa. You did fantastic, and
great
we really
job,
appreciate man. It. I'll always feel at ease if I can't do this to have her take over the reins. She always does a great job. Also, we want to remind everyone next week on the program, Shelley Leibowitz. This is going to be very exciting. Record producer and now film producer with Snoop Dogg. In fact, we hope to get Snoop Dogg on in the next few weeks, so that'll be great. Well, so I want to give everyone a hint. The return of Rick Derringer is going to be on in a couple weeks, too. So we'll look forward to Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo. I'd like to thank Wayne Larson for his fine expertise as our technical engineer. And, of course, Jim Johnson from the studios of Radio Mom 91.1 FM for putting together our musical montage. It's always a fantastic job. I hope everybody has a great week. We had fun tonight. I hope you did enjoy it. Folks, this is Larry Batson, and you have listened to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.